The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
All right, Higher Side Chatters, we spend a lot of time dissecting the problems of the world, and there are many, from multi-generational criminal families of control from behind the curtain of our so-called democracy to the complete corporate rape and pillage of anything and everything, leaving the planet and its people a virtual wasteland in its wake. And that's just the stuff you can talk about in polite company. Yes, the rabbit hole goes much deeper, but are the secrets of Templar magic really going to make your cubicle any less miserable? Will a conversation about spider beans on their moon-based control center contribute to finding your true passion in life? As fun as it is, I'm doubtful. Although what's key is that we find solutions to problems long identified and circumvent the debt-based system of rule. Not grandiose ideas of a technocratic utopia, not pipe dream paradigms of exotic technologies firmly locked behind the gates of possibility for decades. Today we want a real, practical solution we can fight for now, a viable option for providing maximum optionality for all, something within our grasp that breaks the chains of economic slavery and frees each individual to pursue their long stagnant true will. Ladies and gentlemen, for me, I see no better answer than that of a universal basic income. And today we're going to explore it inside and out with our guest, Scott Santons, the king of the basic income concept and the moderator of the basic income community on Reddit. A true honor and a pleasure, Scott, my man. Welcome to the Higher Side.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Thanks for being here. As you can tell, we can be a weird show, but this is a topic that I really do think is the best option for quick and meaningful change. And I hope we can look at it from every angle and get more people on board who might have the wrong impression or might just be entirely unfamiliar. So to start this off, let's just lay it out there. How do you define this concept for the uninitiated?
Yeah, so a basic income is an amount of money sufficient to cover one's basic needs, and it's based on the individual level, so it's not given to households, and it's given without any conditions whatsoever, so you get it regardless of work or not. It's essentially a separate and now permanent income stream of, you know, the US would be like around $1,000 a month or something to start with, but it's just this completely unconditional amount that everybody receives that they can use any way they want to. And of course, they would just have so many effects and so many different things, which, you know, I'm happy to discuss because it really is kind of a very wide-reaching idea to like essentially build a new foundation or a floor underneath people and society on which to build.
Right. It is exactly what it sounds like—a universal basic income. And how much money is typically proposed? Because I do hear some debate here.
Oh, sure. So to be considered a basic income, it needs to be able to meet one's basic needs of, like, say, food and rent, electricity, you know, clothing, like these most basic needs. It's not supposed to be any kind of lavishing amount that essentially vaults people into a middle class lifestyle. It's just purely basic. So then, of course, you know, how do you define that? And, you know, different countries will define essentially the poverty line in different ways. And it's like in the US, the poverty line right now for an individual is $11,880. So when I say a basic income in the United States has to be at least $12,000, that's why I'm saying it has to be there, because you have to be above the poverty line, and that's just how we've defined it. Now, you can say we've pretty arbitrarily defined it, and it could be some other number as well. I think that's another debate to have. But I think that as far as, you know, each country goes, it's up to that country to decide what is that most basic amount. And whatever that is, you know, that's where you can start with the basic income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the idea that it should be around the poverty level. That way people can survive. But if they work a side gig or a creative passion, they can do pretty well for themselves. And that guaranteed safety net keeps people from being stuck at low-paying jobs they hate. They have a little more bargaining power because your shitty corporate boss doesn't have complete leverage over your life.
Yeah, exactly. That really is possibly the most transformational say, power of this idea is that it does grant people the power to say no. And that's something that just doesn't exist yet.
Right.
You can't say no to, let's say, working for $7 an hour if, like, that's all you can find and you have to be able to eat. And so you just, you know, accept this. And there's so many things, other things you accept as well. Like, let's say we're staying in relationships that we don't want to be a part of because we can't really afford to go out on our own. This inability to say no is actually very wide reaching, and it has, you know, effects on even depressing wages. So that's another kind of effect of this as well, is that if you can actually say no to low wage work, and then you suddenly you can say, well, I'll happily work for you for $15 an hour, or I'll happily work for you for 20 hours a week instead of 40 hours a week. But these are my conditions to work for you. And so whereas all the power right now is with employers, with basic income, suddenly that's more of a balanced power between employers and employees. And also for the previous point as well, as far as the amount goes, like it's just there's so much more combinatory power with this as well. So, you know, yeah, $1,000 a month for one person might sound like not a whole lot. But then, of course, just imagine like, say, four people living together in the same house in like a four bedroom house or something. That's $4,000 a month for the total household. So, you know, suddenly when you start looking at sharing of costs and stuff, it really enables people to do so much more. It's kind of like, you know, the success of crowdfunding and what now. You see what can be accomplished when a bunch of people are able to contribute a little bit. And this is another kind of along that, along those same lines.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's how both of us pay the bills. Now, the first criticism that I have faced when talking about this to some people is that they immediately jump on this welfare for all kind of idea. And that's not really a fair criticism, is it?
No, welfare is an entirely different animal. Let's say you can think of welfare as paying people not to work, or let's say welfare is paying people to do nothing, and basic income is paying people to do anything. Like when you have welfare, welfare is a targeted system. So because it's targeted, you're using a bureaucratic system, and you're introducing a bunch of type 2 errors, which means that it's not getting to people that should get it, even by your own definition. And then because it's targeted, then that means you withdraw it when they no longer qualify for it. So, you know, somebody gets it, let's say, because they don't have a job, and then they get a job, and then they no longer get it, in which case that creates the conditions where, let's say, you're earning, you know, $1,500 a month via benefits, and then you get a job, and suddenly you're working, you know, 40 hours a week in this job that you hate, and you're still essentially earning $1,500 a month. It's just now cash from work instead of your benefits.
Right.
You're no better off. Why would we, you know, work in these jobs that we hate? Why would we do like part-time work or gig work or anything if all it does is remove the assistance that we're getting? So the basic income is not welfare because everybody gets it and it's always there. So, you know, if you're getting $1,000 a month in basic income and you get a job, then you're earning, you know, if your job is paying you $1,500 a month, now you're earning $2,500 a month. Right. Like it adds instead of replaces.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because a lot of people who are on welfare, they are incentivized not to work because it's not like their resume has them stacked up for 100,000 a year jobs. So when they do get a job, it's going to be pretty low wage and pretty close to that welfare amount, and that is definitely going to have an impact in their life. If you could just get a job and make 100 grand, then yeah, the welfare money isn't as big a deal in your life anymore, and you can probably pass that up, but that's really not realistic.
Yeah, exactly. Because we have all these different programs, they can add on top of each other, and then they create something that are called welfare cliffs or poverty cliffs. And so what this is that let's say someone is receiving five different programs, and, you know, they've got like, you know, housing assistance and EITC and food stamps and TANF welfare assistance and Medicaid and, you know, whatever, all these different systems stacked up on top of each other. Oh, and childcare too. There's all these things. And let's say they're receiving around the equivalent of $40,000 in benefits. And so then if that person gets a minimum wage job, then they can drop down to a total of earnings from their income and benefits as to being, you know, $20,000, $25,000 or less. So there's a steep drop off, in which case, really, there's no point. Why would anybody get any kind of job. If you lose, it to drop down so that you're not even not better off, but way worse off. And so that's even why Finland is also looking to experiment this as well, is that the entire reason they're really looking into this and they're really interested is because they think that by testing a basic income, they can actually increase the amounts of people working. Because right now with the current system, it seems to disincentivize working for, part-time or, doing a little bit of work here, contractual temp labor. There's so many people are just disincentivized from doing that. Where if you get that floor, then they think that people will take that part-time job, that they will take that temp job.
Absolutely. And there is the argument that some people will be lazy and do nothing, but that exists in our current system. And, go to any intersection in San Diego and I see four homeless people asking for change. There are people doing the minimum now. And wouldn't it be better if we knew that they at least had some quality of life that would disincentivize them from going into areas of crime? That's a big one, I think.
Yeah, I think that we need money to make money. I mean, it is very disincentivizing to have nothing and to not be able to, this idea that we've got bootstraps we can all pull ourselves up by. Like, you can't pull yourself up by your bootstraps if you don't have any boots. So basic income is like a way of giving everybody boots and saying that, okay, now actually it is possible. Like, you do have the ability. So, like, let's say, imagine seeing those people on the street corners again, like those people with signs are asking for money. Right now, they don't have any boots. But with a basic income, they have that money, and everybody knows they have that money. So you actually know that they do have something. And then you're wondering, why is it that they're out here? Do they need extra help? Is there, like, some mental illness going on here? You know that they already have something. Right. And that makes, like, all the difference in the world, I think. And that's also where this idea has been tested, and there's a lot of different places as far as, it's been actually tested. Full universal basic income experiments have been done in Namibia and India, and we've got very similar kind of experiments that have been done using unconditional cash transfers in places like Kenya and Uganda and Liberia and Lebanon. And this is a tool that's being increasingly used to just give people money without conditions. And when we do that, we do see that it does actually enable more people to work. There seems to be a almost innate desire to self-employ. Like, a lot of people have this idea of what they would like to do, start up some kind of business or whatever. But because there's essentially like a built-in scarcity to money, if you have to take out a loan for this, or if you don't even have access to that at all, then how can you do these things? So when you give people money, and we've seen this, that when we do give people money, that people do that. They start up their own businesses, and it expands those local markets too. It really frees people to make more choices as to whatever work that they feel is most important to do.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. And there is so much corruption and manipulation in our current system, though. How do we safeguard against some of that when we're giving everyone even more?
Well, that's the great thing about this too, is that you circle around this bureaucracy. There's no need for this. This is giving directly to people. There's no conditions. It's not that you have to figure out like who should be the ones to get this and why. And then there's, all that bureaucracy that goes into that and all these errors that creep into this as well. You just say, no, what we're doing is just like essentially what they have in Alaska with the annual Alaska dividend. It's just all you got to do is just prove that you are a resident of Alaska each year and you get that dividend. There's nothing else. And once you have that, I mean, it's just so much simpler. And like, they're really the costs of running the Social Security system is actually a very small fraction of that is administrative costs, because all they're doing is just cutting checks to people with a Social Security number that are old enough to qualify. They're in the system. So with this, we actually get around all these administrative bureaucratic problems. You just give it directly to people.
Mm-hmm. And that's also an interesting point. You bring up Alaska. Some people might not realize this. And as we talk about this, they might think, well, this sounds like some fantasy pipe dream that'll never happen. It's kind of happening in Alaska because citizens get broken off from the oil industry for using the land up there. So basically, they're getting a basic income right now. And you can kind of study that to see effects, right?
Yeah. So Alaska has been receiving what we call essentially a partial basic income, but it's the closest thing to universal basic income, I think, anywhere, because the entire state gets it. And so this is not targeted in any way whatsoever. The entire state gets this. And they've been getting it since 1982. And what happens is Alaska takes some of the revenue they charge oil companies, essentially a rent to drill. And then they put a portion of that money into a huge fund, a permanent fund, which is now $50 billion in size. That fund is invested in the markets. And then that that fund earns a huge dividend each year. And then that dividend is divided up between everybody. And so, you know, this is a permanent thing as well. People wonder, oh, like that's going to disappear as soon as like the oil disappears. No, that's what they were smart about doing is they actually essentially converted a non-renewable resource into a renewable resource. They converted oil into cash into a fund. And so every year since 1982, they've been getting around $1,000 a year. And that's per man, woman, and child even. Most recently, it was around $2,100. So, you know, for a family of, let's say, or household of six, then that's $12,000 for the household. So that's actually, you know, quite a bit of money for these larger families. And that really, it's because of that, Alaska has often been at the very top in the far as lowest amounts of poverty goes, lowest inequality. And even as far as like looking at states' measurements of well-being, Alaska is right up there at the top as far as states with the highest well-being of people who are happier and more connected with each other and more connected with their work, healthier. Like it's all, you know, right there in Alaska. And I think it has partially at least to do with this basic income because everyone there does have this income floor. Nobody earns $0 per year. You know, at least they get this certain amount that they always have to look forward to each year. They're able to spend stuff on.
And you also touched on something with the kids that I have been reading about as a possible wrinkle in this system is that there are going to be people, if we give it to every individual, they're going to be people who just have kids for extra checks. And of course, that's just a small, minute detail, and it could be ironed out really easily by saying you only, like, you either put a cap on it at three kids, or you could say people don't get the checks until they're 18. Something could be put in place, but how do you address that issue that people might just be incentivized to have a bunch of kids to get more checks, which is something that I think our welfare system to some degree does now anyway?
Oh, yeah. So this is something that again, it's great to dive into, and it's something that I've learned a lot about this through actually diving into basic income literature and, you know, what are the effects of income on welfare programs and fertility rates and all this stuff. But if you look at the system as designed right now, it has essentially a worse incentive than what people worry about with basic income. So essentially right now, if you're an able-bodied adult without dependents, what's called like an ABOD, then you don't really have any access to welfare assistance. It's only if you have a kid right now that you were able to get some kind of assistance. If you're single, you don't really get anything. So what you're doing right now is saying that, you know, if you are a single individual and you're having a hard time, then you get nothing. But if you have a kid, then we'll give you, let's say, $16,000 a year in benefits. Whereas with a basic income, everybody will already have $12,000 a year in benefits. And then if they have a kid, they'll get an extra $4,000. So this is a difference. You know, right now you're talking about an incentive of $16,000. With a basic income, you're talking about an additional incentive of $4,000. So it's a smaller incentive in the way that people worried about. Now, if you also look at the evidence, so like if you look around the world at the effects of, you know, if you look at developed countries and those countries with higher incomes and even within those countries at the income levels, you have to see this pattern is as people earn more money, they have fewer kids. So you have actually got countries all over the world who are actually worried about not reaching their replacement level, which is around 2.2. So you have to have at least, you know, if you have two people, you need to have two kids in order to replace that. And you actually have a little bit over that. So you have countries that are like at replacement levels of 1.5 or 1.6 or whatever. And they're like, crap, we need to figure out a way to incentivize having kids. So this is this example where people are afraid of something that countries are actually trying actively to do because they need to. The only reason the U.S. isn't shrinking is because of our immigration. And if it had just been just due to fertility rates, we aren't having enough kids to actually prevent a shrinking of the country and therefore the entire economy.
I love it, man. And everyone knows the saying, if you give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish and he eats for life. How do you look at that analogy in the context of what we're talking about?
Yeah, I ask, if we build a robot to fish, do all men starve or do all men eat? This is if we're building technology, I want people to think, like, what is the purpose of the technology that we're building? It seems to me that the purpose of technology is to reduce the amount of work that we as humans have to do and enable us to do more with less.
Cheers.
Yeah, as we create all this great technology, we should actually continue along those lines. We should always be working less. There should always be less toil. I want to make the distinction too, is that there's actually a great deal of work, valuable work that people want to do, but we're locked into lives of toil. And I say, let the machines do all of the toil. If there's something that a human doesn't want to do or something that a machine can do better, faster, for longer, hand that work over to the machines and let humans pursue what it is that we most want to pursue. And right now, we're not doing that. We're building these great machines, this great technology, and the benefits are accruing to a very small percentage of the population while the rest of us are becoming worse and worse off. I mean, the incomes, wages, and salaries have been stagnant since they decoupled from productivity back in 1973 here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's just crazy. And if you look at, you know, just what it is, what kinds of work have we been doing? Like, what are the effects of technology so far? And what we've been seeing is that technology has been essentially eroding all these middle skill jobs, it's just essentially built at the middle class. If you think of the way that cars used to be built by people, if you look at old photos of Ford Motor Company, I mean, these were just like tens of thousands of people who worked on these things. And now over the years, thanks to technology, they were some of the first to be replaced by machines. So now there's so many machines that are building these cars, and there's far fewer people that are doing this as well. You just don't need as many. If you look at photos of a Tesla factory in action, even there's just so many fewer people. And if you look at, as Elon Musk has described of the new Gigafactory, I mean, I haven't seen photos of this yet, but he's having described it as an alien spaceship kind of thing. It's just like there's so much technology and no people around. And so we've been shifting the way that we work from these middle-class, high-wage-paying manufacturing jobs, and we've been getting rid of those and replacing them with these low-wage, low-skill service sector jobs, because those are just the jobs that haven't been automated yet.
Mm-hmm. And that is a fact, man. You know, automation is coming. For people who might be thinking, oh, this sounds too risky, I don't want to upset the economic model too much, I like how it is. Well, tough, because it's changing regardless. Automation is getting better and less costly all the time. So it's dumb to just wait until we're out on our asses or have a serious problem to do something about it.
Exactly. Yeah. We should be leveraging this for our own good. Another thing technology is doing is creating this, we're able to be somewhere more efficient with technology. You know, things like Uber, things like Airbnb, technology has been applied to existing capital and enables us to use these things more efficiently. So let's say, you know, before Uber, there were all these cars that were sitting around that were not being used. And now these cars are being used. So there's less need for even more cars, and more people are able to earn money doing that. And I think that's great, except the problem is that as long as we're eliminating all these other jobs, which we are, because they are inefficient to have these 40-hour-a-week jobs where people can actually be sitting around doing kind of nothing for hours or days or weeks on end, depending, why would we do that? We should actually have a labor market where it's more flexible and people can be called in to work when they need to and then not work when they aren't needed to and do their own thing when they have that free time. But the thing right now is that we're existing in this world without basic income, and therefore all that's doing is creating more insecurity. And people are just barely getting by, and it's even more stressful trying to figure out, how can I possibly pay the rent? And, you know, I'll drive a little bit for Uber here, and I'll work for TaskRabbit here. And so you've got this sharing economy that's coming up that's really having a large effect as well. And we just need that income floor underneath everybody so that, again, it makes things work better for everybody instead of making things worse.
Mm. Well said. And I do like that you talk about this being consistent with any philosophy. Why should conservatives and liberals, libertarians and socialists alike all give their stamp of approval to this thing?
Yeah, there's something about it to like for everyone. And the reason is it's kind of a universal thing. It's like saying, is it a good idea for someone to be able to live inside of a house or to drink water? I mean, these ideas aren't divisive. There is not a libertarian way of drinking water and a socialist way of drinking water. I mean, this is a universal idea of just saying, hey, everybody has basic needs and we should have those basic needs met. And then because of that, there's all these different angles from looking at it. So with a libertarian angle, and for libertarians, freedom should be key. Liberty should be key. People should have the choice and the freedom and the power to direct their own lives. And that's what this enables. If you care about taxation, then that's what, you know, some people will have a problem with taxation as far as, oh, anything that reduces taxes is good and anything that doesn't is bad. Well, with a basic income, it's essentially a universal tax credit for everybody. It's a fairly large universal tax credit that's refundable. So for the most part, most of the population would actually be paying less in income taxes versus those at the very top who are getting, again, accruing most of the benefits of technology. They would be taxed more. But again, we don't even have to do it with income taxes. There are so many ways of doing that as well. And as far as the socialist viewpoint, you say, well, basic income enables people the power to say no, and therefore they have more bargaining power. And unions, the entire point of unions is to increase bargaining power through collective bargaining. So this is bargaining at the individual level. And it also enables what is effectively a universal strike fund. So whereas unions right now have to use union dues and create it like these war chests for strikes so that people can afford to go on strike, with basic income, anyone at any point can actually afford to go on strike.
Mm.
So it enhances that. And as far as people who don't like government bureaucracy, then this reduces that. You don't need all these administrators and bureaucrats overlooking these things. You can just get rid of those. Those jobs don't need to exist anymore. And it will just give money directly to people. This is less power of government over people because they don't have, you know, the same abilities that they have right now, where they're essentially reaching into people's lives and bedrooms and trying to force them to do this or that through coercion or carrots and sticks and all this stuff. With basic income, it's just basic income. You don't need all that. And if you have people who care about capitalism and markets, and of course, you know, we're looking at Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek like the idea because basic income is essentially a market solution, we have markets. Markets need money. People, in order for the price function to work, in order for supply and demand to be calculated by this giant distributed computer we call the market, people have to have money in order to provide those signals as to what they want to purchase and therefore what manufacturers should be creating and shipping where and when. And so by having more money into the system, that system works better. Like the markets are able to be more efficient in figuring out what it is people want and, you know, where these goods and services should go. And those who are worried about the future, and even as it is right now when we're seeing stagnant or falling aggregate demand, if robots and machines and software are doing our work for us, you know, they may be doing our work for us, but they're not buying anything. They're not consumers. So you can think of basic income as this consumer kind of dividend where people actually have to have money that the machines aren't making in order to purchase what the machines are producing. And so you're hearing about calls for helicopter money from bankers and for people worried about markets because they're worried about what happens when you've got these shrinking markets even across the world. It's just kind of a stagnant situation right now. So there's just so many ways to look at this.
Right, man. All great points. And I wanted to read this little thing you have on the subreddit about how it simplifies the tax code because it touches on several things that you just laid out. But it says there is no need for tax brackets having different tax rates when people receive a basic income, since the basic income effectively causes the same tax rate structure, only requiring two numbers to be chosen, the value of the basic income allowance and the flat tax rate. With less thresholds and tax rates to play around with, taxation becomes less politicized and less used as a weapon of class warfare. This also simplifies your IRS paperwork and makes the tax structure smoother and thus non-susceptible to income shifting. I mean, there it is. That's like four benefits wrapped up in just a couple of sentences.
Yeah, exactly. I love the idea of a flat tax with a basic income, and I don't think it necessarily should be the only way of paying for it, because I think that there are other ways that I would like to see included as well. But I do like the idea of essentially switching to a flat tax system and giving everybody essentially the same income tax. So everybody's taxed the same on what they earn via quote unquote hard work. But then if you look at like capital gains, you know, if capital is replacing labor, and therefore, essentially, robots, you know, are capital, then how do you get at that money? I think it makes sense to tax that somehow. So I think a tax on capital gains makes sense as well in order to essentially create that system. And I think that there are taxes like Pigouvian taxes that make sense, like a carbon tax, where we're taxing an externality that we want to reduce and price into the market. Like, I think that makes sense. You know, there's just a lot of different ways, land value tax, financial transaction taxes. I think that we should get away from taxing human labor, and I think we should tax other things. And so I like this, you know, the switching of a flat tax. And part of that, again, like you mentioned, is this great simplification of the tax code, because you don't need all these tax credits and deductions and loopholes and all these things that people are paying and lobbying to be put into the code. Like, it's, their tax code is way too complex. And if we just essentially look at and try to create this universal tax credit that would be a basic income, then we can get rid of all of that, which would really remove a bunch of distortions from the market as well.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of a religion with segments of this audience that taxation is theft, period. No room for negotiation. And that is not my view, because I think that money, to be used wisely and the way it wants to be used, it needs to circulate. And I think a basic income could give it to the people, and then the taxes will help it circulate back to government, who will then put it back in the hands of people. And really, I look at it as an attempt at trickle-up economics instead of trickle-down. We start the money at the top, and it never gets to the bottom. But if we started at the bottom, where people must spend money, they don't have these billions in the bank, so they can't just hoard. They must eat. They must pay rent. So the money will circulate with their purchases, and it'll eventually get to the hands of the millionaires. I'm sure they'll find a way, but let's start it at the bottom, at least. Let's try.
Yeah, yeah. And part of this as well is that, you know, this is another way of paying for a basic income that I like as well. And this is through citizen seigniorage. So this is the idea that instead of letting banks create the money as debt, that we should actually just create it publicly and create that money. And so money should essentially be born in the hands of citizens instead of the hands of bankers. And if we did that, then let's say, you know, right now, you know, we've created just trillions of dollars over the past few years through quantitative easing. And we've been creating this money and just throwing it at banks and then hoping that banks would lend it out to people, because again, that's how we grow the money supply, is through banks. And a lot of people don't know that, but well over 90% of our money is created that way.
Yeah.
And so our money supply is growing in that way. So if we did it with citizen seigniorage and we just said, okay, let's stop doing that and let's create money for people instead, then you could actually create tax-free dollars in the hands of people. And it could be, let's say, $100 of the basic income per month, or $200 of the basic income per month. I mean, it depends on what we want to choose as that. But we could actually do this through just money creation for citizens. That is a possibility. And I like how more people are actually talking about that as well, because if we did it that way, then we would reduce the taxation need. And there are even some who want to just create the money whole and just say, hey, let's just give people money. Don't even bother about taxing at all. Let's just give people money, and then we'll just index the basic income to inflation so that it rises with it. Now, so some people would freak out about the idea of inflation with that. And whereas you've got other people like Bill Gross, who are looking at this, and, you know, he's a billionaire investor like Janus Capital, and he likes the idea of universal basic income. And I think he likes the idea of just creating money and giving it to people instead of taxing it is because he's a billionaire. So if you get to have your choice as to what funding mechanism you want to use to pay for a basic income, I think there are those like him and even those who hate the idea of taxes that would like this idea of citizen seniorage instead, or as part of the mix as well.
Right. And you bring up a great point about how money is created. If banks are going to just print money out of thin air in a fractional reserve banking system, it might as well get given to the people instead of traded for bonds with the government. And then basically the Federal Reserve kind of owns the U.S. government.
Yeah. And I just don't like this idea even of we need money. This is a public good. Nothing works without money in people's hands to use in the system. So this is something that we all need. And yet what we're doing is giving it to banks. And then the only way we can get it is to go into debt and then to pay interest on that debt to the banks. So there's never enough money to cover everything. So you have to have a growing economy. Your aim has to be economic growth because everyone's always having to pay for the interest. So that in itself is just an entirely unsustainable model. What we should be looking for is to create the system that is essentially a circuit. It's a, you know, a way of circling this money through the system. It's like creating a circulatory system for the entire economy. Whereas right now, there is no circulatory system. Like you said before, it's just going up to the top and some of it is just staying there and it's not going back down. So base income is like the creation of a pump or the addition of a heart into the system so that it actually creates this circulation, so that you don't any longer need this unsustainable growth that we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the numbers a bit more, the feasibility of it all. How do we know that the country can afford it? How does that all work out? I'm sure you've looked at it.
Oh, sure. So it's a lot cheaper than people think it is, because I call this napkin math, because what you'll do is you'll figure out, like, anybody can just take the number of the basic income and then multiply it by the number of people, and then they come up with this number and go, well, that's impossible. You know, that's $4 trillion or $5 trillion or, you know, whatever. And, you know, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So you can't look at the system, through basic income without the taxation system itself. Because again, what this is the creation or a diversification of income streams so that everybody is given an income stream from the government, but also there's the taxation system is still there. So, you know, let's say as far as when we're talking about a net cost of basic income. So imagine if I gave you $20 and asked for $10 back, you know, what is the net cost of that transaction for me? Was it $20 or was it $10? And of course, the net was $10. So with a basic income, you're giving money to everybody. You know, there's a lot of people who'll be getting, let's say, $12,000, but then those same people might be giving $12,000 back through income taxes. And so for that, that's a net cost of zero in that case. Whereas if somebody who's earning a lot more money, let's say their tax burden goes up $24,000 and they're getting a $12,000 basic income. So then their net tax increase is $12,000. So if you look at just net increase, what is the net cost that we actually have to do? It's actually not even the $3 trillion napkin math number, which would be for a $12,000 basic income in addition to a $4,000 basic income for kids. That's about $2.98 trillion total. But if you do a net cost, then that drops down to at around $900 billion. That's the total amount of money that we essentially need to transfer from the top 20% of the population with the most of the money who are gaining most everything from technology down to the bottom three quintiles with $12,000 per person in the bottom 20% and around $8,000, you know, in the bottom, you know, the next 20% and then $4,000 the next 20%. So as people earn more money, it will be reduced through however, you know, this taxation system that we set up works. So it's a lot cheaper than what people think it is just at the net cost. However, even after that, then you need to look at, okay, so what are the programs that we already have that we no longer need anymore? Or even another way, a simpler way to looking at this is how many programs do people no longer qualify for if everyone's already now earning $12,000 a year? So, you know, you can imagine right now, it can be very difficult to qualify for food stamps. You know, maybe you have to be earning $2,000 a year or something where you are. So if you're earning this $12,000 a year, you don't qualify. So there's so many programs that no longer exist. There's so much money that we're not spending on these other programs anymore, but we're spending on basic income instead. So the cost needs to be subtracted from that as well. And so the cost, after all these elimination of programs, you know, the federal bureaucracy and elimination of even of all these tax credits and deductions and subsidies and loopholes that we don't need anymore, then it's actually a matter of a few hundred billion dollars, really, depending on whatever, you know, mechanisms that we choose to fund it and how many programs you want to eliminate and how far we want to simplify the tax code. So there's a lot of choices involved in this that changes the cost number, but it really is just a lot cheaper than people think it is. And then on top of this, and this is what I think is really one of the biggest arguments for it as well, is that it pays for itself. We will actually save money on all these other expenditures that we no longer need, that we don't see as expenditures. So when I say that, I mean, if you're paying $800 a month for your healthcare premium, and base income leads to a healthier population, which we have seen because even in the Canada test in Delft, Manitoba, where they tested this basic income guarantee for 5 years, hospitalization rates went down almost 10%. And we know that there's such a connection between health and income, with higher rates of cancer and heart disease and diabetes and all these things that cost a lot of money. So essentially, if we can reduce those premiums down from $800 a month to, say, $400 a month or whatever, then that's that much money that we've saved that people are no longer spending elsewhere. You know, the cost of crime in the U.S. has been calculated over $1 trillion per year. So if this reduces crime, which again we've seen in Namibia, the universal basic income experiment there reduced crime by 42%. So if we reduce crime here in the U.S., where we're spending, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year to house people in prison, and they would not be in prison if they'd just been given $12,000 of basic income instead, then we're talking about spending a lot less money than we already have. This is actually a cost saver. It's not a net expense. It's a net surplus.
Mm-hmm. And that is an interesting point about criminals, because this is a question that I've seen come up, is how will this work with criminals? Number one, I think most crimes are out of economic necessity and of not feeling a part of your community, which if your community is giving you a check every month, you're inclined to just feel a bit more a part of it and you have something to lose. But how would this work with criminals? Because one suggestion I've heard is that if someone gets incarcerated, their basic income should go to pay for their food and housing in the jail system. And I don't think there's much of a problem with that. But what are your thoughts on criminals and a basic income?
Yeah, I think this is one of those details that needs to be looked into, and people will, you know, debate this. And I actually do think it makes sense for the money to actually be used for their housing and food expenses. You know, why should we have to raise taxes to pay for food and housing when everyone's already guaranteed food and housing? So I think that makes sense. What I don't like is I don't like that idea within a privatized prison system.
Mm-hmm.
There just seems to be a possibility, with profit being the gain for this, that it could be a kind of like a kids for cash kind of system that's already messed up. So I don't like the privatized system as it is, but I think that there's definitely a way to help reform the system through this. And I also like the idea of, again, leveraging technology. So if you're looking at nonviolent offenders, and everybody has money for their basic needs, then it becomes possible for people to be imprisoned at home with the ankle bracelets and whatnot that track them. Mm. And, you know, we've actually seen a lot of good outcomes from that as far as like nonviolent offenders go. You don't need to put them into prisons. You can, if you're just looking about trying to limit their freedoms in society for a while, then why not just have them in their homes, not bothering anybody and knowing that they're there? And it's so much cheaper to do that. And then again, you're not having to worry about prison expenses at all, or the private prison industry at all. You're just saying, hey, let's use technology to temporarily imprison people at home. And I think that makes a lot more sense.
Absolutely, man. That's a great idea. I don't think I've ever really heard proposed before. It addresses a lot of issues for sure. Nonviolent offenders now are oftentimes faced with sexual and violent trauma that really shouldn't be a part of their sentence, and some don't ever really come back from it. And people also say that when the only people you're locked in with are criminals, scams and schemes for later start getting cooked up. That wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that idea, man.
Yeah, our recidivism rates are just ridiculous here in the U.S. And it's just so many people get out of prison and they just go right back. And like you mentioned, ways that, let's say, they could have been socialized into that. But also, it's just so much of an economic thing as well, where if you have to check that box to get a job that says if you have ever committed a felony or, you know, been in prison for anything, then you're definitely not going to get that job pretty much. So people are coming out of prison, and we say that doing your time and then you should be okay. But people are doing their time and they're coming out and then they're unable to earn incomes, and then they end up having to earn incomes illegally or, you know, whatever, just to try to get by, and then they get back into prison. It's just so wasteful the way that we do things right now.
Hell yeah. And I did want to step back to the Manitoba pilot experiment in Canada that you mentioned. It had an 8.5 reduction in hospitalization in the community. Mm-hmm. I took down a note on that where the study says they found this reduction to be a direct result of the minimum income. And it goes on to say this was attributed to the reduction in workplace injuries and family violence resulting from the rise in incomes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of a dark way to look at something like spousal abuse and hitting your kids, but it's stress. I mean, how do you put a price on the overall stress reduction? And like you brought up earlier, sometimes when a relationship does get abusive, the flip side is that they can't even leave because of the economic reasons. So it's a little odd to talk about giving people money to not hit their wives, but stress reduction is a beautiful thing overall. And giving people this basic income has measurable results.
Yeah. And that's one of these things that I've seen across studies and findings. So it's not just in Canada where this kind of result was seen. There have been studies of income assistance programs and violence, family violence rates. And again, you see that decrease. One of my favorite experiments too, aside from the Manitoba experiment, was kind of natural experiment that was just very serendipitous. And this was the Great Smoky Mountains study, or came out of the Great Smoky Mountains study in North Carolina. And so this was meant to be a longitudinal study, which means a long-term, 10 years long study of kids in poverty. And a few years into this study, where they were just looking at kids and wanted to observe them for a long time, a large group of those kids whose family were Cherokee started getting a dividend from the local casino, and that dividend grew over time. So essentially for the next decade, on average, around $4,000 per person, per adult who was receiving this. And you know, it's even continued to grow. But they found that this increase in incomes that was not based on anything, it was unconditional and you received it. And it wasn't like welfare where you're able to build money on top of it, actually. This was an income floor for these houses. It's like one of the closest things I've seen to a basic income experiment, really. And they found that again, it did decrease stress in the households, because really one of the things families most argue about, any couple most argue about, is money. So by reducing that stress about money, by people knowing that they could pay for their basic needs, that the parents actually, they fought less. They were able to spend more time with their kids. The kids grew up in these better environments where there was actually even a reduced alcohol consumption as well. And the kids actually had striking personality differences when they looked at this over 10 years later, where these kids raised in these households in these better environments, they're more willing to work with other people. They're less worried about things. They have these like stronger, what's called big five personality factors. Yeah, you know, it's like psychology phrasing. And like, so they have healthier personalities. And another thing about this is that the general consensus is that kids' personalities are kind of more flexible. And then as you get older, it hardens, you know, mm-hmm. kind of, and then stops kind of like really shifting all that much. So if we're able to create a whole generation of kids with healthier personalities, and then those all lock in as adults, because of the basic income. You just imagine how much of a difference that itself would make. And then, of course, that is something that builds. So all those kids grow up as adults, and then they have their own kids, and then their kids are raised in with basic income, you know, households. With this reduction of stress and this increase in security, you're looking at some major psychological differences that create for a better society.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that is great information. And, you know, we are a show of largely conspiracy folks. And the narrative is that government wants everyone dependent on it, so it cements its power. I know this sort of sounds like in this paradigm, we're giving the government a lot of control and a lot of power as a provider. Can you say anything to ease those concerns?
Yeah. So first of all, I always like looking at evidence, and I look at programs like Social Security and the Alaska Dividend, and it seems like those populations have so much more, I would say, civic power. Those in Alaska actually vote in higher numbers. They are empowered as citizens. They want to make sure that because they don't want to lose that dividend, that they actually vote in greater numbers. They have more control, essentially, over their government. Mm-hmm. And with Social Security, you see the same thing. Like, we know that senior citizens are a strong voting contingent of society, where they've got more time on their hands, and they vote in larger numbers. And because of that, the government caters to them. With the Medicare D was kind of the bigger program that came out recently, and that happened because of senior citizens. They're the ones that the government cares most about. You got to keep them happy. Let's make sure that we keep them happy because they vote more. And that's really what it comes down to, is that basic income actually creates a stronger population of citizens. And citizens are what really comprise the government. If we're thinking about government as like an us versus them thing, then you can see that you get this idea that it's, you know, us versus them, and it's power versus the weak. But if you look at government as actually what it is, which is, I mean, we are a system of the people, by the people, for the people, then you want a nation of citizens who vote and who have the ability to be engaged, to be politically engaged, to go out and get signatures for something and go out and get people to vote for their idea that feels important, or their representative that feels important. If we can create a country of people who are more engaged as citizens, then that's, again, it's a much better country than it is now, where we've got this system that is kind of ignoring the needs of most everybody, and it's just focused on the needs of, you know, the wealthiest and the most powerful.
Right. I mean, those are great points. And when someone is not so economically stressed, they can actually take a second to look up and see how their community is being run. They can actually take the time to care about politics, because they're not so just go, go, go in this dog eat dog system that we have right now. And it's still a choice. In this new paradigm, it would still be a choice to be dependent on the state or not. I mean, it is right now. People who have these concerns, you could choose to do nothing and be dependent on the state, or you can work, and that isn't a problem. The basic income system, you could still do the same. If you felt like, oh, I'm just worried about the fact that I'm dependent on this basic income, well, then work so much that the basic income is extra, and then those concerns for you personally would go away. And is it any better than being dependent on the shitty company that we work for now?
Exactly. That there is a dependence right now on these companies, where how secure are you when you are dependent on a company? I talk about this as far as rights go. How secure is your job if you can be fired by one person for something that you say? Like, maybe you say something on Facebook, maybe you say something on Twitter, and you know, maybe you decide that you want to become a part of this march, you know, on the weekend or whatever, and someone sees that, and that prevents you from getting a job in the future, or you lose your job now. There's a lot of job insecurity involved, and it's also paired with this lack of real freedom of speech. If you feel unable to express your ideas that are most important to you out of fear of losing your job, and that's something that's out of dependence on your job, on this, mm-hmm. on having to have a job in order to live. As soon as you cut that connection and allow people to live without a job, then you can actually be more vocal about what's important to you, and you're able to, you know, you have that freedom of speech. You have you have these rights that are essentially infringed without it. And the other part about this too is that we are interdependent. We try to avoid this. We love thinking of us as just purely independent, but we're not. I mean, if anybody just looks around, I mean, nobody built everything around them. You know, they purchased it through the work of other people. No one, how many people can actually build their computer from scratch, and how many people alive could build things if it wasn't for the people in the past who are long dead who actually came up with the ideas and built it in the first place. I mean, we are an interdependent society. And so all this is doing is just really recognizing that. It's saying that, yeah, we are interdependent. It's not that we're dependent or codependent or independent. It's just saying, hey, we all need each other, and this is lifting us all up and enabling us to do more.
Oh, yeah, I am right there with you. And you make a great point about asking, how free are we really now? Another example I can remember is back in the Occupy days when I thought marching did something. I had friends who would say, man, I actually really care about these issues and I would love to go down there, but I can't risk getting arrested. I got to be at work in the morning. And that fear keeps everybody in place, really, to be honest, because it is a legitimate concern. Cops arrest protesters, even if it's just for a night. That could be enough to get someone fired and then thus destroy them financially. So yeah, we have a lot of problems, but people can't even put energy into the things they want to change because of this. So if you're conspiracy minded and want to get the ball rolling on the balance of power and real change, this is a good way to get it started.
Yeah, exactly. If you really want to look at this as a possible conspiracy of, the ruling elites or whatever, is that with this question of why aren't there people out on the streets? Why aren't there people out on the streets? It's because we've created a system where that is very difficult to do. People are afraid to go out on the streets because they don't want to lose your job. People are unable to do these things because they don't have the money to do them. They don't want to lose their housing. They don't want to be unable to eat. And so we aren't doing what we should be doing to actually be more in control of our lives. And that's exactly what the elite want us to be, is to feel disempowered. Like if you look at just at income and voting, it's crazy to me how if you're earning over six figures, on average, 80% of the people will vote. And if you're earning $15,000 or less, 30% of the people will vote. Why is that? What is the reasoning behind that? And what are the effects of that? I think that there's so much of this disempowerment. And for those who are familiar with this idea of learned helplessness in psychology, that you can learn to be helpless even when you're not. And it's funny too, there's actually been experiments that show that just telling someone that they have no power to change something can actually teach them helplessness. So this idea that we are unable to do things, that itself is damaging. People need to know that they can actually make a difference. And with basic income too, enabling that, then we can start changing things to really take back control.
It is inspiring to hear that things are kind of picking up for it. How close are we in the States, realistically, do you think, to getting this on the table?
Well, I think that we won't be seeing it on a national level until, I would say, at least after 2020 and maybe at the earliest of 2024, unless that we really push for it together. If people just expect that they can kind of just watch it unfold and eventually start receiving a basic income, I think that that potential just means that maybe you'll get it in 2028 or something instead of what you could have gotten in 2022 if we really start to mobilize. And I think that self-driving technology is really driving this conversation a lot faster, because it too is growing fast. And artificial intelligence, new things like deep learning, you know, forms of machine learning, this is really getting people to think about this on a national level. I mean, you just had it discussed in Congress for the first time recently, just looking at automation and the potential for basic income. Just recently, the most recent news was that Comma.ai announced that they'd have a $999 upgrade package for a lot of cars with the necessary equipment at the moment to be upgraded to self-driving, to the point of basically being like Tesla's with the autopilot feature. And so just announcements like that just make it seem that much more real and that much faster to happen. With Uber driving, there's going to be in Pittsburgh now, you've got, you can do rides with a self-driving car. Like, that's, you know, a real thing. And people see this, and, you know, they'll see cars driving themselves, and they'll see lawyers that are actually AI software. And it gets people thinking, like, oh my gosh, this is the future, and it's going to be increasingly difficult to earn incomes. And so let's talk about this, and let's get this done somehow on the national stage. So that's going to happen. Now, what's the best way to go about that? What's like the best first step? I really like the idea of a carbon fee and dividend. Let's add a cost to carbon, and let's refund that cost to everybody, you know, as a dividend, because that would actually reduce global warming, rates of CO2 pollution, at the same time as increasing incomes, and also getting people used to all universally receiving an income without conditions and seen as a right, you know, something that is owed to them. That's one foot in the door that is immediate step I think is possible on both a national level and a state level. You know, Oregon and Washington will be voting on this. Washington, D.C. is looking at this. So that's an ability there. And I also think that, you know, we do have states like Washington and Colorado who have voted to legalize marijuana. They're going to also look at basic income as saying, okay, what can we do? Like, could it be a carbon tax and dividend, or could it be something like a land value tax and dividend? Like, what are the options that we have on the state levels and even the city levels or county levels to introduce the idea of dividends to everybody without strings? And those are also, I think, strategies that are great ideas. And I hope to see those starting to come up. I think we will start to see various states and cities, you know, look into this as well.
Yeah, man, these are amazing, interesting times. I mean, 10 years ago, we were still using flip phones. Now we have the iPhone. So I can only imagine what kind of implementation will happen in the next 10 years. These are exciting times. Before we go, are there resources you'd recommend that people check out if they want to dig into this deeper? Where would you have them go?
Oh, yeah. So definitely, if you want to dive in, go to reddit.com/r/basic income. That's the basic income subreddit. And, you know, that's had dozens of links added to it on a daily basis for years now. It's organized also by, you can look at articles, blogs, you can look at only anti-UBI articles, you can look at, you know, studies, papers, you know, videos. Like, it's all like just categorized. You can go through there and really, really jump in. And also just even the FAQ there itself is pretty informative, and it's got like a large compilated, you know, compiled list of evidence sources. So basically a lot of what I talked about of the various locations that have what I would call evidence pointing towards basic income is, you know, all there, huge list to look at. So yeah, definitely check that out. And, you can find my writings at scottsanton.com. You know, I'm on Twitter at @scottsantons. And I've actually got a big frequently asked questions compilation of essentially just dozens of blogs and articles I've written about various aspects of basic income as well, that I think is a good starting point to research the idea further.
Right on, man. All great stuff. I really do appreciate your time. Can't thank you enough. You are a true champion of progress, my man. And you did start to sound a little robotic there towards the end, but that's just a sign of the times, I think. So keep fighting the good fight, man. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot for having me.
You got it.
Take care.
Peace, man.
Bye.
All right, people. How was that? I hope it got you thinking. Maybe this is one we can actually share with people without making too many eyes roll. It could be a real practical solution. And some people are going to be worried about the role of big government. But let's be honest, it's not getting significantly smaller anytime soon, regardless of how much we scream and yell on Facebook. We might as well have it giving some power to the people first, right? I see no reason not to try it. I see no reason why we shouldn't force every politician to talk about it when we get a chance. I don't think of it as a handout. I think of it as a base standard that everyone can build off of, something closer to the original point of a society in the first place? I mean, think about how seriously crime would drop. The tent cities in your downtown areas, gone. When everyone has something to lose. And we can definitely afford it. It should be the first thing on our list. Provide basic needs for the citizens and a little military security and a constantly improving infrastructure. And that's basically it. That is all I want for my government. We can keep it small, but it needs to do the basics. I'm not one of these I want zero government people. I just can't be. I don't find it realistic. But our system could be tweaked so that government power isn't such an attractive thing for sociopaths by making it government service, like it was supposed to be. Obviously, there's a lot that needs to be done, and everyone has a different plan to do it, and that's part of the problem, really. But if we could get enough people to rally around this one concrete idea, I don't see a downside, especially a downside that doesn't already exist now. And if you see some fatal flaw that we didn't discuss, let's hash it out on the Plus forums, which I think I have fixed now. We had some capacity issues, but I have got the limits raised, and I think we're back in action. But let's talk about it. Let's find an issue with it that can't be adjusted or accounted for. That's the only way we get to a real, workable solution. In other news, for THC Plus listeners, the first part of the Armenia video is finally up. It's about 40 minutes. It covers just the first 5 sites that we saw on the Graham Hancock tour I went on last year. There's going to be at least 2 more parts because we did see so much. In this first one, we didn't even get to the buried pyramid yet or the conflict we got into with some very Orthodox priests. That was a wild one. But if you've ever wanted to sign up for Plus, please help me out and pull the trigger on just like a 3-month package or something for yourself, a small token of your appreciation for the stuff you've enjoyed, and you can see the 5 sites in Armenia that I think are pretty impressive, including an active pagan temple and Svartnots, which has some really interesting things coded into it, and a sacrifice chamber and an altar. There's a definite case to be made about some natural technology used there in the past. It's cool. Plus, you get to eavesdrop on some Graham conversation and see me. You almost never get to see me. Not that I'm too much to look at, but whenever I listen to a podcast where I never see the host, I'm always curious. So maybe that's something some of you share. I don't know. But in this Plus show, of course, we did just talk more about the basic income and areas where it comes into play. Immigration is a big one. Ideas on how it could work with criminals and people covering their own prison costs. I think that was on the Plus show. Either way, I just love it. I love taking the power back from our collective bosses and giving the people an actual bargaining chip when negotiating for a job. We wouldn't be all so damn desperate like they got us now. And the effects on small business too. Because you have a basic income, you can now start a little business and it doesn't need to be a putting all your eggs in one scary basket type situation like it is now. And other people will have a little extra to spend in those small businesses. So they require less income to stay open and end up getting a little more because everyone has it to spend. It's a beautiful thing. We all know that the shadowy elite use poverty as a weapon, so let's try to disarm them there a little bit. And our optionality will open up so much we can probably avoid a lot of the other stuff too. So either way, I hope you guys learned something, maybe feel motivated about a new option that seems slightly more realistic than others. You know, I've had these guys on about free energy technologies or alternative fuels or eco-housing and Venus Project-type resource-based economy models, and there just never seems to be any real progress year after year. It's just talk. It's just planning. But I think this could be different, and I'd like to see the idea grow. In fact, a basic income could be the fuel that these resource-based economy communities would need to get off the ground. We can tweak the numbers, we can move the levers around until it's completely optimized, we can debate what details are best, but let's get politicians talking about this and watch them squirm when they try to explain why money shouldn't start with improving the lives of people as they see fit, before it does anything else. Like my man Scott said, let's at least give everybody boots to pull themselves up from in the first place. And with that, I'll see you next time. I've done what I can. Your move, greedy politicians, locust-like lobbyists, and abusive bosses. Your fucking move.
Happy Pride. happy holidays and Merry Christmas. We're going to talk about angels and miracles with Rosemary for a few hours tonight.
Coast AM, day after Christmas. All the angels in the heart.
What Genesis did right.
It's getting old. It isn't pleasing. I turn the station. I am done. Maybe it's not my department. Maybe I should shut my mouth. Mr. Jones is quite the harlot with all the ads he's reading now.
Working with my team, we set out to find the best for
but
the
it's fine. Now that I have THC, I'm feeling more at home than I ever have before. InfoWars are just drowning slowly. Coast to coast isn't going nowhere. All these shows are just drowning slowly. I'm sure you must feel kinda dirty after each commercial spot. Tuning in at certain hours on demand is what I want. THC, it's the show that I adore. Now I'm feeling more at home than I ever have before. InfoWars are just drowning slowly. Coast to coast isn't going nowhere. All these shows are just drowning slowly. InfoWars are just drowning slowly. Coast to coast isn't going nowhere. All these shows are just drowning slowly.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehighersidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the five shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provide it all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site if you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices. I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon, but I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehiresidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehiresidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle, sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the 5 shows the previous month, and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?